I'll talk first. I'll give a little outline to axion physics just to put you in the mood. I don't think this is really necessary, but maybe you have to shift a little bit from what you're doing.
No, it's good. We've heard a lot of weak dark matter, so it's good to.
I know this is the minority view, but I'll argue that axions are different because they make a Bose-Einstein condensate. They are degenerate gas, and if they interact sufficiently quickly, they would make a Bose-Einstein condensate. And you may already ask, how will they interact quickly since they are thought to be weakly interacting particles? Then I'll have to spend quite a bit of time developing this tool of the inner caustics of galactic halos. I claim that the inner caustics have a certain property, and that you can really, this actually, I claim there was evidence for this inner caustics over a number of years, but it really bothered me because I couldn't really explain how this could occur, except that I believe Bose-Einstein condensation gives the answer to this, and it actually gives a really perfect fit, as I'll explain. Then, if there's time, I'll also indicate how axions may affect the measurement of cosmological parameters, which may be good or bad, depending, probably bad, depending on what the measurements will be. So, if you don't mind, I'll remind you that the standard model, even though it's tremendously successful, has this little puzzle that you wouldn't have expected in the standard model that the strong interactions would conserve CP because of this term GG dual, which, as Mark already pointed out, is a four divergence and therefore has no perturbative effects, actually has no classical effects, but it has non-perturbative effects. And they were identified as instantons by het Hooft. And if then theta is different from zero, you have CP violation in strong interactions, no such CP violation is seen, and you have a severe limit of 10 to the minus 10 on the parameter that a priori you would have expected to be of order one. And this is a little puzzle that has remained with us. Peccei and Quinn provided, oops. Peccei and Quinn provided a way to remove the puzzle by postulating a U1 symmetry with certain properties. It is spontaneously broken at some scale, and it has a Nambu-Goldstone boson, which becomes the theta parameter. So theta becomes a dynamical field, and it can then relax to zero, and its quantum is the axion, and as Weinberg and Wilczek pointed out, it's a particle that you can go look for. One nice thing about this is that the prediction of the axion depends on very few parameters, mainly depends upon this axion decay constant, the scale at which Peccei-Quinn symmetry is broken. There's further model dependence, but it is relatively weak. Now, axions have a long history and fortunately have never been put into evidence. And so a lot of the one-dimensional parameter space is ruled out. The heaviest axions fail to show up in rare particle decays and beam dumps. Intermediate mass axions going down in mass, by the way, and therefore also more weakly coupled, are ruled out because stellar evolution works very well. And then the lowest axion masses are ruled out because of cosmology, because if you make the mass very small, then you will overproduce axions. And here you may well say, well, wait a minute, because usually when the mass goes down, the density goes down. But what's special about axions is that it has two populations. The population you usually think of is a thermal population here called the hot population of particles produced by some interaction, and the typical momentum is the temperature when it was produced. There is another population in the case of axions, which you don't always think of, because when you quantize a field, you quantize it about the zero, the minimum of the potential. But actually, the field need not have found this very quickly. In the case of axions, when the mass is very small, it will take some time for it to find this minimum. And it has a new population of axions called cold axions, whose typical momentum doesn't have to do with the temperature, but with the horizon. And there is 18 orders of magnitude between the temperature, say, at QCD time, and the horizon. The horizon is 2 times 10 to the minus 7 seconds, then corresponds to momentum. The inverse of T1 is 3 times 10 to the minus 9 eV. So these long wavelength wiggles correspond to a very cold population. Anyways, this time T1 will appear many times. Okay, so I'll refer to it. Is it a time when the axion mass turns on during the QCD phase transition when the temperature is roughly 1 GeV? Yeah, so to go in a little bit more detail, at very high temperatures, the Peltier-Quinn symmetry is restored. The Peltier-Quinn field phi here has zero expectation value, then at temperatures below the scale of order, the Peltier-Quinn scale, the symmetry is spontaneously broken. The axion is now the degree of freedom at the bottom of the Mexican head potential. And then at 1 GeV temperature, this Mexican head potential tilts, and the axion acquire mass. You also have topological defects associated with axions, like domain walls and strings, but they all disappear. They should all disappear, I should say, during the QCD phase transition. There are some conditions from that, but okay, let's not go into this. Okay, so above 1 GeV temperature, the axion field lies anywhere at the bottom of the Mexican head potential. At 1 GeV temperature, the Mexican head potential gets tilted, the axion field begins to oscillate. You can see that if the axion mass is very small, it has difficulty, the field has difficulty finding the minimum. And that's a basic reason why the energy density in these cold axions becomes larger when the axion mass goes down to zero, and it becomes critical roughly at the micro EV or 10 to the minus 5 EV or so. By the way, ask questions anytime, okay? I prefer it that way. Okay, so let's look a little bit at the properties of these cold axions. You can estimate the number density at this time T1, and the center to 47 per centimeter cube. Today it's about 10 to the 9 or something. You can look at their velocity dispersion, which is very small because the momentum is typically given by the inverse of the horizon. And of course, when the universe expands, it becomes colder yet. From these two numbers, you can obtain the phase space density. And you take the physical space density and you divide by the volume in momentum space. And this number is huge. It's 10 to the 61 in natural units where you have set h bar equal to 1. So h bar cubed is a volume in phase space. This number tells you what is the quantum state occupation number of those states that are highly occupied. Okay.
Here the relation between F and the mass of the axion and the known
mass
of dark matter in the universe?
Yes, right. This is the standard estimate, okay, from vacuum misalignment. This is saying that the typical momentum is given by the horizon at QCD and then it scales with the expansion of the universe. This number here is invariant by Liouville's theorem because the phase space density doesn't change with the expansion of the universe. And it's very big. And so it's natural to ask, is this a Bose-Einstein condensate? So there are actually four conditions for Bose-Einstein condensation. One is that you must have identical bosons. They're indistinguishable. This is actually what's surprising, actually, is because when we grow up as little kids, we don't grow up with the idea of indistinguishable bosons, okay? Everything we know, we distinguish. The second condition is that these particles must be highly condensed in phase space. And this is certainly satisfied here, as I just showed. 10 to the 61 is much bigger than 1. actually, for atoms in the laboratory, that is the condition that's difficult to satisfy, because you have to cool the atoms to some very low temperature before you have phase space density of order 1. The total number must be conserved. In the case of axions, the axions, for example, decay to 2 photons, but the decay rate is very long, very slow compared to the age of the universe, so actually axion number is effectively conserved. The one condition that is not obvious in the case of axions is that they thermalize, because Bose-Einstein condensation is a statement about thermal equilibrium. It says that if these conditions are satisfied, and if they are in thermal equilibrium, then most of the axions go to the lowest energy available state.
Regarding the total number conserved, you do have processes where you have axion converging photons.
Yes.
Right now it's negligible, but back then when the electron density was pretty high.
Yes, but it's still very low. Yeah, it's really very well conserved. Now, I want to here indicate why this is a robust phenomenon, because I didn't know this a few years ago, that Bose-Einstein condensation is really something very compelling. You may think if they have to work so hard to make this happen, it's very fleeting, you know. But this would be misleading. Yes, please. You're putting your finger exactly on the critical issues, okay? You have to make a distinction between all the axions being in the same state, coherent state, and that this is a Bose-Einstein condensate where the state is the lowest energy state. And since you brought it up, let's have a box, okay? And we put axions in the lowest energy state. And they're all in the lowest energy state practically. But now we move the box around. So the state will be, after a while, no longer the lowest energy state. It will still be a coherent state. If they are non-interacting particles, they'll just all stay in the same state. I want to be talking about the rethermalizing Bose-Einstein condensate, where they interact and regain the lowest energy state. This happens on a certain time scale. It's important to think about this, because on sufficiently small time scales, this will not happen. And it's also important to think about what the interaction is that would make this happen.
Because normally you would have thought that Bose-Einstein, they normally carry a charge, and that's what keeps them from disappearing, losing their energy by just disappearing. And you're saying that basically because the interactions are so slow, effectively it's as if they have a charge, which is kind of...
Yes. Yes. They effectively are conserved. Okay. Nothing is, even baryons may be unstable, right? As Feynman said, statistical mechanics is when everything that happens quickly has happened already. Everything that happens slowly hasn't happened yet. Right? It's always important to keep this in mind in these discussions.
So there is a fine tuning, seems there, that you want the interactions to be fast enough to thermalize, but not too fast to produce or to produce particles.
As you will see, however, the interactions, thank you, that do thermalization are axion number conserving. So that's not an issue here. But in principle, you're right. There will be gravitational interactions, which may be another surprise. Gravity, axion scattering conserves the number of axions.
Oh, so that's, you think that's the one that thermalizes?
Right, okay. But let's not have too many surprises at once. So first I wanted to explain that Bose-Einstein condensation is a very robust phenomenon. So imagine that you have maybe 100 states here, and they're very highly occupied, 10 to the 61 particles in every state. This configuration has very little entropy, right? Very little entropy. I can just give you these 100 numbers and this one. Okay, so now I take half of these particles and I put them in the lowest energy state. And the energy released will be very big. and I give it to the remaining half, and there will be an excited state. Now you can count the number of states, microstates, that does this, and there will be a huge number. And that's basically why Bose-Einstein condensation happens. It's for identical particles. See, what's special about, if the particles were not identical, this would also have a lot of entropy. But because the particles are identical, this has very little entropy. And you increase the entropy by putting them all in the lowest energy state, and a few of them in excited states that carry a lot of entropy. Okay. Now this is actually, I think, the slide that you provoked earlier, right? That you have to make a distinction between a coherent state where you put all the axons in the same state. Well, that is one kind of phenomenology. This has certain properties. And a Bose-Einstein condensate that rethermalizes sufficiently quickly that the axions track the lowest energy state. And I will claim the second for axions. So here, the question is, what is this interaction? And it is gravity, it appears. And this may also be very strange to you, because gravity you don't think as a thermalizing interaction, because atoms in this room, for example, have completely negligible gravitational interactions. But you have to realize that these axions occupy in huge numbers very low momentum state, that is to say state with very long wavelengths, and gravity is long range. If the wavelength is of the state is, say, a parsec, it does create a gravitational field that will push, affect the other modes. In a graph, you would write it like this. And there's a whole story about this. I don't want to go into it. But so basically, the reason this is important is that if both of these have very low momentum, the momentum transfer is very small. Gravity has this 1 upon q squared. The relaxation rate involves then the correlation length squared. And actually, if you estimate this at this time T1 at QCD, you find that relative to the Hubble rate, it's much smaller than the Hubble rate, but that it increases like the scale factor. And so 10 to the 7 scale factors later, or at roughly 500 eV photon temperature, this will happen, that these axions will almost all go to the lowest energy available state. And then, in principle, although this is somewhat hard to imagine, these patches will become as big as the horizon. I don't see why not, because they shouldn't become bigger than the horizon by causality, but in principle, they will all go to the lowest energy state within the horizon. Yes. Well, that's also a very good point. In fact, this is the last part of the lecture, because that is an issue, okay? Right. So in principle, you have to worry about that. But we did worry about it, okay? And you'll see what happens. Okay, so now, if you put all the particles in the same state.
Sorry, go on. Yes. So why do you think this actually leads to thermalization? I mean, there is gravitational scattering, but you have gravitational scattering in other, or coherent gravitational scattering in other systems, but they don't become thermalized. Like, for example, dark matter halos in simulations, there is coherent gravitational scattering, but they don't end up as.
That's correct. Yes.
So I'm just saying, going from having coherent gravitational scattering to thermal state, I think it's something that needs to be justified. I don't think it happens all the time.
No, you need, that's right. I agree with you. You have to do some real calculation. But, you know, I didn't put it here, but the upshot of it is this formula for the relaxation rate. And if you want to use the formula for WIMPs, what will happen is that the correlation length for WIMPs is practically zero, and this phenomenon does not exist.
No, but there is no WIMPs come in clumps, right? In like halos or subhalos.
Yes.
So that's a large correlation length. unless you're talking about a different type of correlation.
Yeah, it's not the same correlation length as this, right. Okay. Right. So here, the picture is that you have, imagine you have a wave of axions, and it is a parsec big.
Yeah.
And it associated with it is a gravitational field, and it pushes against the other modes of the axion field, and you don't have the analog of that. With any other dark matter.
Why is that different from like a parsec size dark matter halo, which is pushing against other dark matter?
Well, the.
I got a question. Anyway, is this similar to the thermalization of small scale modes into cell damping? Chemical potential for the photons. I mean, I have a given horizon, right? And there are small scale modes. And are those small scale perturbations smoothing out the second order in perturbation theory? Is that what's going on?
I think both of you are talking about modes in an effective field. I'm talking about modes on a fundamental field. I don't think it's the same at all.
Why are they different?
You do not have quantum interference between the different modes that you talk about, say with you have a clump of WIMPs or you have density perturbations. I think this is what you're mentioning, right? Density perturbations.
I'm just wondering whether you get the same result by considering evolution of scalar field perturbation along with gravitational field, along with Einstein's equations, the second order perturbation.
That may very well be the case. If you have a scalar field, I think you can apply this formula. You have to ask what is the density and what is the correlation length. And this would give you the relaxation rate. And it may very well happen. I don't know the specific case. But it is a scalar field. It's not the fluctuations in, say, WIMP density. I think it would not behave that way. Fluctuations in WIMP density would not behave.
Can you actually show that you get Boltzmann distribution out of this? You have a thermal distribution out of this? Or just show that there's large interaction difference?
Yes, I only show it's large interactions. I assume that it will then go to a state of largest entropy.
That's the key thing. So I mean, as I say, saying gravitational processes, there's a so-called dynamical relaxation, which makes galaxies or anything you see in the universe the way they are. So there are very strong interactions that lead to relaxed objects, but they don't lead to thermal states. So you could have, and usually the difference is that if you have Markovian processes or correlated processes at non-quantum scale, Markovian processes can give you thermal states, but if you have correlated processes or non-Markovian, then you don't necessarily get.
No, but
stuttering, I think what you're reading the show is that there is enough momentum transfer in the direction.
Right, right.
The momentum transfer is large, and then you'll terminate.
No, but now that's the thing. If your first interaction is your interaction I is uncorrelated from your interaction I plus one, then you can do their randomness arguments that give you get thermal states. But if all these interactions are correlated with each other, then you don't have to.
What do you mean correlated? I mean, presumably, you know, one axion scatter transfers its momentum to another axion, which then go on and transfer the momentum to another axion. So at this picture, all that matters is
until the coherence length becomes the size of the system, and then there is essentially one big lump. Mm-hmm. And so that's, I think that's the problem, that like in gravitational systems, for example, the scattering is all happening, everything is a scattering of everything at the same time. So you cannot really consider them as random processes.
So what I'm hearing is that you're making a distinction between full thermalization and relaxation.
Yeah.
Right? So, for example, if you have inflow of dark matter in a galaxy, it's not fully thermalized, but it is relaxed. That is to say, for a coarse grain observer, it may be approximated thermalization, but for fine grained observer,
it is not. Exactly.
I appreciate this. This is for the full relaxation. Okay, so this on this time scale estimates the time it would take for every momentum state to get completely depleted and to populate entirely any other momentum state.
Even though everything is happening by the scale of the coherence length, you would think all the modes become diagonalized, even though I would think that if you have a coherence length L, all the interactions happen on a scale L, so things that are smaller than that scale are not the beings.
Well, no. In this case, everything is highly correlated. There is no independent correlations on.
I want to let you go outside. I didn't want to stop.
No, but these are very. There's a lot of subtleties associated with this. I think actually I should maybe to be really careful, is that this is the relaxation rate. That allows a complete redistribution of these very cold axions. Mm-hmm. It doesn't actually imply that the highly excited thermal axions get fully thermalized, but that's not necessary for Bose-Einstein condensation. So there's a subtlety along the lines maybe that you're thinking of. But it is very unlike relaxation in a gravitational system, okay, at any rate.
Do you think there's a difference between Sorry,
let's talk about it later.
Yeah.
Is that okay?
That's fine.
I don't want to, I have to be a little bit efficient, otherwise.
I have one more question.
Please.
It's more vague. Just naively, can I not demo? Why do we have to go by gravitational interactions? Because in principle, if you can convert a photon into an axion, you would also think that you can thermalize by.
We looked at two processes. One is self-interactions and gravity. Actually, we didn't think gravity till later. Self-interactions, as it turns out, is able to thermalize the axions at time t1, but then maybe putting it all in the same state, but is not able to re-thermalize it later. Whereas this gravity is very weak at time t1, but becomes more and more important in thermalizing axions as time goes on, because the correlation length basically grows as the universe expands.
So you're saying it's actually misleading to look at a Feynman diagram like this, because it's more, it's not really binary scatterings which thermalize, but it's more linear.
No, I think I wouldn't say the diagram is misleading. You just have to imagine that you have 10 to the 61 particles in each one of the states on the outside legs.
Naive question would be, why don't you square the amplitude to get the rate?
All right, so, okay. This is also a good question. There's a lot of, we worked on this for a long time, actually, before understanding this. Normally, you write the relaxation rate as follows. Sigma, density, delta V, okay? For example, for weak WIMP kinetic relaxation, okay? This formula, and then if you have highly condensed states, you multiply, as it turns out, you multiply by one factor, not two, of the average occupation number. It turns out this formula, if you derive it, assumes that the energy spread is much bigger than the relaxation rate. In fact, the notion of cross-section, if you remember, involves a time average, which gives you energy conservation. And when you do this, you're basically assuming this condition. In the case of axions, actually, the energy spread is extremely small, because the momentum spread is given by the horizon, and this momentum squared. It turns out that at time t1, this is equal to Hubble rate, and afterwards, it is less than the Hubble rate. So you're in a different regime where we call this the condensed regime. And this is we call the polar kinetic regime. So this is why you don't see it, the coupling squared. You can.
That makes it sound very much like resonant neutrinos moving through the sun or something, where you've got a very small splitting between degenerate species, and then a very small interaction, and then there's a regime where the interaction would be large and the interaction would be small, and the transition gives you the resonance kind of thing. But none of that gives you the coherence in the sense that.
Yeah, I guess it would be somewhat similar to that. Nice. All right. We show, by the way, that at the boundary between the two regimes, the two formulas agree. But you couldn't use this formula in this regime. It would not be consistent because of this. You're not allowed to do this time averaging that you normally do and you're used to doing. Okay. So this happens at a temperature of order 500 EV, presumably. Can you make any distinction between axions and ordinary WIMPs, say, on this basis? This would seem like an obvious question. This is the photon temperature, yeah. Yeah, at a time. So it's before equality by some factor, okay? So this comes back to this issue earlier. If all the axions stay in the same state, you can show, so this is like describing dark matter by a wave function. Wave function for all the state that the particles are in. I think Nick Kaiser and Larry Widrow perhaps were the first to show that you cannot make a distinction between CDM and this description, except on very small scales that are not observable. So in the case of axions, as long as they all stay in the same state, and this would happen in the linear regime and within the horizon, you cannot make a distinction between axion back and WIMP. There are some distinctions. For example, the equation for the evolution of density perturbations has an extra term, which is not present for ordinary cold dark matter. And this term implies a gene's length. But this gene's length is too small to be of relevance to observation. However, when you are in the nonlinear regime and when you thermalize, perhaps because the horizon grows and you must put axions into thermal equilibrium that were causally disconnected before, then you may have distinctions. And actually, I claim that that you make a distinction by the study of the caustics of galactic halos. So now I have to introduce this tool. Okay, this will take a little while. So although this is not often mentioned, I think not enough mentioned, cold dark matter will form caustics in physical space. First thing to realize is that when you talk about a collisionless fluid, you should talk about it in phase space, not in physical space. This is because this is another thing we grow up with. Fluid like water, water is collisionless, collision full, and so it means that every physical position, there's a single density and a single velocity, But for neutrinos, at a single, and in this room, the velocity distribution is completely arbitrary, also for WIMPs and for axions. So that you have to talk about a distribution which is a function of position and velocity, or phase space distribution. And this phase space we are not used to, okay, it takes a while. So I have this little exercise, okay, where I have one dimensional physical direction and its associated velocity. So this is a two-dimensional phase space, x, x dot. And I first put particles there on our right, here, the particles are moving to the left because they have negative velocity. The particles on the left are moving to the right. And this distribution you can actually describe by having everywhere a single velocity and a well-defined density distribution. But because the particles are collisionless, later on, this distribution, although completely smooth in phase space, will become singular in physical space. So in this example, the particles on the left moved to the right. I don't have a stick, perhaps. Is there some? No.
One in a space one.
You can see what I mean, perhaps, right? So the particles on the left move to the right, and the particles on the right move to the left, and you see it's now folded in phase space. And you have two things that happen. First of all, that the velocity is no more single valued in x space. Oh, thank you very much. I guess with the warm weather,
well,
there is no more use for this.
If any person really bothers you, you know what to do.
Okay, so then you have multiple streams, actually, and where the number of streams changes, say, from 1 to 3, you have a infinite density in physical space because the phase space sheet runs parallel to the velocity axis, and so when you project it onto the physical space, you have a large density. Okay, so I always thought it was an interesting question to try and locate the position of this sheet in phase space. And so it's easy to do in a homogeneous universe because there simply the Hubble expansion gives one the position. So if I take an arbitrary direction z and then its associated velocity z dot, the velocity is proportional to the distance. And so the particles lie on this red line. The thickness of the line is the velocity dispersion. And this is of order 10 to the minus 12 for WIMPs today, for the 10 to the minus 17 for axions, and of order 10 to the minus 8 for stellar neutrinos. As time goes on, this particle will just move here. So the line will become more flat. And it also will become thinner because it's really stretching. And by Liouville's theorem, it must then become thinner. So as time goes on, this sheet in phase space will become wiggly because of density perturbations. It will not become fuzzy, but wiggly. And as time goes on further, when you enter the nonlinear regime, the sheet will start to wrap around itself so that you have here, for example, three flows. There's one flow there. So in the nonlinear regime, say this density would be three times bigger than there, roughly speaking. And you would have caustics where the number of flows changes. It wraps clockwise because you know from classical mechanics that in phase space around an attractive potential, things will always move clockwise. Okay, so we are sitting in a galactic halo, that of the Milky Way, and the sheet will have wrapped up many times. The number of coverings at their location is of order 100, it turns out, because that is the ratio of the age of the universe divided by the infall time at their location. And you have the prediction that you have discrete flows. So this, at our position here, for example, there's one flow of particles falling in from there, and then one flow up there of particles falling in from the opposite side. And then here's a flow of particles that fell in from this side, went all the way out and come back here and so forth. And you have caustics where the number of flows changes. And this first caustic happens where the flow that fell in latest, fell in recently, falls in, goes all the way out and goes to a maximum radius before falling back in. This is called second turnaround. At first turnaround, there's no caustic. Okay, that this happens, you can illustrate by looking at elliptical galaxies that have wiggles of light around them, not from dark matter, but from stars. And the phenomenon is that the elliptical galaxy has eaten a little galaxy, and it has stretched it in phase space and then wrapped it around. And when it's projected onto the sky, you have these ripples. And you can simulate this and see that it is consistent. Now, there are actually two kinds of caustics, inner caustics and outer caustics. The outer caustics occur when you have an inflow that goes all the way out, and then when it falls in, it stays there a little bit, makes an outer caustic. You can also show that when you have an inflow and then it becomes an outflow, this necessarily makes a caustic. You can show this mathematically. And with Arvind Natarayan, we simulated this to find out what kind of caustic you form as a function of the velocity distribution, the angular momentum distribution on the turnaround sphere. And we found that if the dark matter falls in with what we call net overall rotation, like this, then you make a ring. And this is a picture of the ring in the case of axial symmetry. And this is a picture of the flow of particles near the ring. So actually, near the equator, the particles come in and out. Then you have particles go in this way, particles go that way. And then you have all these intermediate particles. And make this beautiful caustic called the elliptic umbilic. If the velocity field is irrotational, you have, by the way, the Tricuspid spring I was able to figure out just analytically. But the case of irrotational flow was too complicated, and we only have done it by simulation. And it shows a different kind of caustic, which we call the tent, which looks something like that. So this is part of the logic that I'm going to use, is that the dark matter makes different inner caustics depending upon the angular momentum distribution with which it falls in. Now, when I first noticed that there are these caustic rings, I got excited and I wanted to predict where they are in our galaxy. And I used a self-similar info model of Fillmore and Goldreich and Bertschinger, which we had actually generalized to give it angular momentum, because the original model doesn't have angular momentum. And if you take this model, then you would predict that the caustics are on the galactic plane and at specific radii, 40 kiloparsec in our galaxy divided by an integer. So 40, 20, 13.3, 10, 8, and so forth. And in other galaxies, you have to scale it proportional to the rotation velocity and to one parameter per galaxy. But for our own galaxy, we already estimated this to be of order 0.18. And so this was basically a prediction then. So I'm now going to give evidence for these caustic rings. Okay, of course, it's a little dirty and so forth. And
so you mentioned the entire halo is rotating?
Yes.
That's a serious amount of angular momentum.
Are you asking about the amount of angular momentum that is?
Hard to see where how would you from the evolution of the galaxy, where would you get so much angular momentum?
Okay, I'll come back to that. So I want you to suspend disbelief for a moment, because axions are special and they will do something special that I will show later. Because actually you're right that although I claim evidence for this, I couldn't explain the evidence and it was really difficult. So the evidence that I'm going to show is based upon the idea that if you have these caustic rings in the galactic plane, this is the bulge, this is the disk, this is the rotation curve, this is the caustic in cross section in the galactic plane, you'll have a perturbation of the rotation curve. And because the density is infinite here, you have actually kink in the rotation curve. And we went to look for this, and with Will Kinney, actually, we took 32 well-measured extended rotation curves and put them on top of one another, scaling them according to the formula, saying caustic ring radii proportional to the velocity, rotation velocity. And we found, in fact, these two bumps of significance 3.1 and 2.6 sigma at 40 kiloparsec and 20 kiloparsec.
But this doesn't look like the other one that you showed. This doesn't look like the previous slide that is old bumps.
Yes, you're right.
So what are they?
No, but you have to realize, first of all, the rotation curves have many bumps. Okay, caustics is just one cause. And you put them rotation curves all on top of one another, so there's statistical noise. So you are saying, see, when you put all the rotation curves on top of one another, you don't expect that these caustics would align perfectly, right? You would expect it to
be. I don't expect a flat line at all. So I would guess they would wash out.
Well, that's actually plausible. Why would they wash out? So actually, here, we rescale by the rotation velocity, and so that effect is removed. But there's one parameter you're left over. So what you actually expect is that you have one distribution of J max over the set, and it repeats for n equal 1, n equal 2, and so forth. So it will wash out depending whether this distribution is peaked or not. If it is highly peaked, you would see, in fact, you would expect to see what we found. But if you had found nothing, you would have presumably said the distribution is so broad, even if they are caustic rings, that you do not see it. I mean, your expectation is very reasonable, I agree. But in fact, we did find the caustic rings. We need not have, actually. For own Milky Way rotation curve, it's only really well measured on the inside, and you expect roughly 10 caustics between 3.5 kiloparsec and our position at 8.5 kiloparsec. And you see in the rotation curve these sharp rises. And there's roughly the right number. And also they have more or less the correct positions, and they have very sharp transitions because the rises really turn around on a single data point. Let me skip a couple. This is the outer rotation curve of our galaxy, and it has a rise at 13.3 kiloparsec. After caustic rings were predicted at 20 kiloparsec, people found the Monoceros ring of stars at 20 kiloparsec. Okay, which is usually is given a different interpretation, but here it's exactly where the caustic ring was predicted. And finally, I think you may ask, why don't you look at the rotation curve of Andromeda? And actually, until recently, about a year and a half ago, wasn't that well measured, but Laurent Chemin and collaborators measured the rotation curve of Andromeda, and see, it has a peak here, and a peak there. And if you look at the positions of the peak, okay, roughly 30 kiloparsec divided by 2 is 15, divided by 3 is 10. It has, in fact, three peaks. And by the way, this is the galactic disk of Andromeda is over here. There was no expectation of there being any peaks at all from the standard models like NFW profile and so forth.
What are the different colors, then?
Okay, so the red color is one side of the galaxy, blue the other side, and the black is the average. And if you look closely at data, it's not nothing always exactly what you wish. Okay, this is very nice because here you see that there's a peak on one side of the galaxy and there's one on the other side of the galaxy. It's completely correlated. What would cause that? And also the spiral arms over here, you know. And here also it's very nice, although one radius is a little different. Here you see that actually there's a peak in the blue, but not in the red. But I'd say, well, maybe the ring is a little bit off the galactic plane. God knows. Okay. You know, when you have data, it's... If you live with data, life is always a little messy, right? So, I've claimed there was evidence for these caustic rings and with very specific properties, but as you said, would you expect this at all? This has very specific assumptions being made here. One is net oval rotation to have rings. One is axial symmetry, which is maybe not so shocking. And cell similarity maybe is not so shocking. But net oval rotation actually is shocking, and this really bothered me, because do you expect this? What you actually need, let me see. Okay, I have 5 minutes.
Oh, yeah.
5 minutes, 10 minutes.
10 minutes.
Because we start a little later. Because you're already tired, I think. But
we all grown ups here, people can
take it. To produce the rings at the right places, you need this angular momentum distribution on the turnaround sphere. It has three properties. One, an overall size. You mentioned overall size. It needs to have net overall rotation in red. And it must have a specific time dependence, which was that of the self-similar model. Self-similar model depends upon the parameter epsilon, but the value of epsilon should be close to 0.3. The time dependence is actually what gives the rings at these ratios of 1 upon n. Is this plausible at all? In fact, it is implausible. The default theory of the angular momentum of galaxies is titled Hawking. Galaxies have angular momentum, say this galaxy here, has angular momentum because it has a neighbor and because it is inhomogeneous. So, for example, it has a blob here and is pulled by the neighbor, and there's a blob here and is pulled by the neighbor. But this blob is bigger and it is further than this blob. So the angular momentum given is that way. And actually, in the standard picture, the angular momentum of galaxies is many blobs like this falling in with different pieces of angular momentum. And the final angular momentum is just a random walk. Is very different from what I'm talking about. Another way to say this is that the velocity field of CDM, ordinary cold dark matter, is curl free, because the expansion of the universe removed any primordial curl, and Newtonian gravity will only produce a curl free velocity field. If you have no curl to start with, it will not produce any. And so therefore, if the flows are irrotational, the caustics, there are caustics in WIMPs, but they are, have this general structure, not the string ring caustics of which, for which I claimed evidence. So now this is the highlight of the seminar here. Be appropriately skeptical. I'm not. Here you have axions, okay? They're around the same galaxy. They have the same density perturbations, but they are built by this with very long wavelength modes in the axion field. You have to do a little calculation, but the gravity between these modes is sufficiently strong to put all the axions in the lowest energy state, consistent with the angular momentum acquired. A few axions are then in excited states producing entropy. So even though this blob is pulled that way and this blob is pulled this way, actually the axion flows this way. Because in a way, the axions are everywhere at once. Now, you have to do a calculation. You have to show that the relaxation rate is sufficiently fast on the scale on which the galaxy forms. But we did this. You could check our latest paper. if you have a conserved angle, you ask what is the lowest energy state for given total angular momentum. It's a state of net oval rotation, because the angular momentum is shared. And now you have the right kind of caustic. Okay, great. That's wonderful. So we have, in fact, what was maybe the most difficult part, which is to obtain net oval rotation.
Sorry, don't you get a disk when you do that calculation?
How about this?
Okay.
So you, how about that Pierre finish, and then we'll
okay. So I claim there's two miracles happening here, because I had obtained the value of J max. J max actually determines the total angular momentum acquired. You can estimate this. This is in the spirit of what you said, I think. Estacio and collaborators estimated the total angular momentum acquired by galaxy. They express it by this quantity, which is 0.05. It turns out, if you follow this formula, which you can derive, it's exactly 0.18, right on the dot. There's another thing, is this: do you get the correct time dependence that produces the 1 upon n dependence of the caustic ring radii? And yes, you can calculate this, because what you look at, you look at this, you just ask how much does the total angular momentum grow by estimating how big is the torque at a given time. And then linear perturbation theory is given by this formula, and I'm sure you won't want to follow all the algebra, but you find that the torque goes like t to the 2/3. It goes like the scale factor, and therefore the angular momentum goes like t to the 5/3. And that turns out to be exactly the time dependence of this factor for epsilon equal to 0.33, and epsilon was supposed to be close to 0.3. So that's the second miracle. So my conclusion is the dark matter looks like axions. And I saw that stop here. I have a little bit more, but Mark is going to ask what about other species that may get into thermal contact. Okay, great. Well, thank you.
So, yes, here we have a question.
Okay, so just this last part. If I understand correctly, you said you want to minimize energy for a fixed angular momentum.
Yes.
That's what you said. But then you get a disk, not the head of.
You mean a rigid? No, what?
Well, you get a disk. So everything, but if you want to, is it the previous slide? I don't know.
Yeah.
The one that you had, you talked about angular momentum. Yeah, that's the one. So this, the minimum energy state at angular momentum is a disk, it's not a halo.
Well, actually, you have to, this is this business of, you reach the lowest energy state that is available in the time scale, and the appropriate time scale. You do not, although...
I thought you just argued that you have enough time to get the thermal equilibrium.
This is not an absolute thing. Okay, so if you ask what is the lowest energy state, it's a black hole.
No, at the fixed angular momentum, it's not a black hole. It's at the fixed angular momentum, it's a disk. So
but
very low angular momentum to follow that.
Yeah, but that couldn't actually happen. Okay, what can happen?
Why not?
You seem
to have a process to remove energy into these very energetic states. If you don't have that process that works efficiently, then you're going to go to lowest energy state, which is the disk.
No. That will not happen.
Why not?
Because this is not part of the coherent. This only happens because the axions are very coherent and very slowly moving, very long coherent lengths. Once you're going to put them in the disk, this coherence is lost. Also, once they fall in, they don't thermalize anymore because. So this happens during this time when they're expanding, they're falling in. You represent them by a bunch of angular momentum modes. And I'm saying you can shift axions between these angular momentum modes, but you will not be putting them in a disk.
Yeah, it seems that both of them are kind of, you're doing macroscopic things to the axion distribution. One of them, you're putting all of them in the same angular momentum mode. The other one, you're putting them in the same spatial z direction, in the z component. So, I mean, they're both macroscopic. So I don't see why one is easier or harder than the other one.
Yeah, okay. I understand what you're saying.
Okay.
But,
this may be something that discusses later, just in the interest of time. My other point is that the argument for having 100 caustics is a one-dimensional argument based on a spherical collapse. But if you have 3 dimensions, and in each direction, so you could, in principle, have 3 integrals of motion and 3 angle variables. You would have, in each direction, you could form, up to that order, 100 caustics for generic initial plantation. So generically, you form 10 to the 6 caustics, not 100, if you have 3 dimensions. Because in every direction, in every dimension, you would have, you form a lot of them.
No, that I would not agree with.
And of course, this comes out of simulations as well.
No, the other direction is the radial one, because that's the one that's oscillating. The other directions are angular directions.
But you assume it's completely isotropic or it's axis symmetric. But in reality, you have as much inhomogeneities in those directions as you do in the radial direction. So
what matters is the direction in which the particles oscillate. Actually, maybe we should go back to this.
And they can oscillate in all 3 directions in general.
No, they oscillate in the radial direction.
But you agree that there's angular motion, so there is oscillation in the angular direction. And
it doesn't oscillate, however, because of angular momentum conservation. Would you have predicted that you have caustics other than in the radial direction here?
Yes. Yeah, there could be. This is a various. We don't know the initial conditions for this system. So, I mean, if you talk to Lars Rehnquist, for example, now he doesn't agree with his paper from 20 years ago. That if you look at actual simulation, you don't get that from this kind of initial conditions. So,
you mean he doesn't agree with?
Yeah.
His own paper.
Yeah. The reason is that. This is a very restricted simulation. You have like a tiny elliptical galaxy that falls in a big one. But in reality, there are lots of them.
Yeah.
So you don't get like distinct caustic type. You get like hundreds of them. So you're not going to be able to see one of them. So he thinks when I talk to him, he thinks that you could have, like, if you have mergers of these galaxies, you can get that in structures because those are major events. So these guys, the things that are shown here are minor events if you have a tiny guy that falls into the big one. And then there are lots of them happening over time. So you're not going to see one big shell structure. Yeah. But if you have major merger events with cold structure, then... But anyway, that's a side issue, just that is my conversation.
But if you have a major merger, I would expect that this caustic structure would get destroyed. I mean, it's really based upon the idea of very smooth, continuous infall.
But that's why I say there is a disconnect there. Right? There is, if you should go into the simulation and look where you can see these shell-like structures, and the place that you do actually see them is when you have 2 disk galaxies that merge with each other. In other cases, you don't. So.
Yeah, but I use this as an illustration. You know, not really. Yeah.
But so that's. I guess, and that's not my point either. My point is that in reality, you have 3 dimensions, and then you have to do a realistic simulation. And in those, you see more like 10 to the 6 than 100. So, just leave it at that.
I agreed with many of your things you said, but that I don't think I okay. I'll
So they can talk about it.
I can talk about that, yeah. Any other questions?
Okay, well, let's thank you here once again.